This is the Wat Chen Lake 2023 Bible School. Our third class speaker is our brother Carl Perry. The theme for this week is the life of Jacob. And our first class is entitled, The Elder Shall Serve the Younger. Brother Carl.
Well, thank you, Brother Tim, and good evening, brothers and sisters and young people. Well, in Genesis 25, we are introduced to the genealogy of Jacob. And it comes there in verse 19 through his parents. These are the generations. Verse 19 of Isaac, Abraham's son. Abraham begat Isaac, and Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rebekah to wife, the daughter of Bethuel, the Syrian of Padan Aram, the sister to Laban, the Syrian. Now, it is not a frequent practice of the scriptures to give the genealogy of the wife. But here we have a specific genealogy related to Rebekah. Rebekah was a beautiful woman. We learn that in chapter 24 and verse 16. Very attractive. She was kind. She was considerate. But she has a problem. And the problem has to do with her genealogy listed here in verse 20. She is a Syrian. Not a Hebrew. She is a Syrian. Her name actually means fettering. In fact, Jesenius says it means a rope with a noose. Not a very flattering name to give to your daughter. But she was of the house of Bethuel, which means wasted of God. And really, that's what Syria does. Syria fetters you, chains you, wastes you. And although she was a wonderful woman, she nevertheless had this baggage of being a Syrian. She wasn't a crosser over. She wasn't a Hebrew. She was in a household that was very much bent on material gain, material things. And she was related to the greatest deceiver of the Genesis record, Laban. Why should the record tell us that she was related to Laban the Syrian? Because he was the worst deceiver. And she is part of that family. She has a significant problem. She is beautiful. She is friendly. She's outgoing. She's unselfish. She's courageous. I mean, would you send your daughter 800 miles on a camel to meet a person you never met before to be married? And she said yes. She said yes. But within her is the guile of Syria. And tragically, we're going to see that emerge in the life of Jacob. Now, the record says that she was barren in verse 21. Isaac experiences the same trial that his father, his grandfather, Abraham, experienced. Barrenness. What would you do in that circumstance? You've been promised a seed. And year passes, year passes, year. In fact, it was 20 years after they married before that child was conceived. 20 years, sisters, waiting for a child. Abraham and Sarah waited 25 years. An enormous pressure on the family, that the hope of conception dashed again every month, every year. So what are you going to do about that? Well, Isaac did the right thing. The record says in verse 21, he entreated Yahweh for his wife. And that tells us that Isaac is a man of prayer. He is a man who wants God to answer, has trust that God will answer, believes in the significance of the seed of promise. He is a godly man in so many respects. And the record says that Yahweh listened to that. Now, isn't that interesting? The conception didn't take place until the prayer occurred. And if Isaac hadn't prayed, would the delay have been longer? But Yahweh expects his people to pray to him in their hour of need. And he was entreated, and Rebekah conceived. And God answered that prayer with not just one boy, but two. Two entirely different children. And verse 22 expresses to us the enormous struggle that was occurring in the womb of Rebekah. The record says that the children, the sons, struggle together within her. And that's a very forceful word in the Hebrew. It really means to crush or to oppress. There was a warfare going on in the womb of Rebecca. Now, sisters, I'm sure that that would be most uncomfortable bearing a child. To bear two children wrestling in the womb would be an enormous trial. And it wasn't just gentle touch tag. It's a wrestling match. A crushing, a wrestling match within her. The fight is within her. That really is a parable, isn't it? The struggle is within us all. The warfare is within us all. And this wrestling match actually finds its counterpart later on when God wrestled with Jacob. We're going to see that there's a number of allusions back to this incident. What's Rebecca going to do? Well, she said in verse 22, if it be so, why am I thus? Young's literal says, if this is right, why am I thus? She knew that the conception that she had was of God, but she was puzzled that if the blessings of God come like this, do I need these blessings? But she took it to God in prayer. She went to inquire of Yahweh. Now that tells us that within the Abrahamic camp was a specific place where you could go and pray and seek answers and receive answers. You know, we sometimes forget that in this encampment there was this direct connection between God and his people. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob were prophets, says the psalmist. And there's a specific place and a specific revelation. Now, this tells us a great deal about Rebecca. She's a godly woman. She could easily have bottled this up and become highly depressed over this circumstance, but she took it to God, and that's where we take our problems. We take them to God. And just like her husband, she had this full confidence that God would provide an answer, and he did. And in verse 23, we are told God's answer. Now, how did this answer came? We're not told. Was it through a vision? Was it through a night vision? Was it an apparition? Did the angel appear to her? We don't know any of those details, but we do know that an answer came. And it would have been an astounding answer. She asked about the children, and she received an answer concerning nations. This is a national destiny. Each of these boys would be a progenitor of different nations. There's a national purpose being worked out here. So we have gone from Abraham having a single seed, Isaac, and now Isaac is going to have a national development. So the promises of God are going to take on a different dimension, a different perspective. But these two children, these two boys, would be entirely different. In fact, that word separated, they'll be separated from the womb, is used of the division of the nations in Genesis chapter 10. It's the word used where Abraham said to Lot, separate thyself. There will be an absolute distinctive difference with these two boys. Now that's unusual, highly unusual. Twins generally, even though they may not look alike, have very similar characteristics, but not these two boys. They would have nothing in common. They would go their own ways, and they'd be parted from birth right through to death. The one people, said God, shall be stronger than the other people. And that implies that the antagonism which was working itself out in Rebecca would now become a national antagonistic concept. One would eventually have dominion over the other. It's the means by which God's purpose would be extended nationally. Amazing, isn't it, when you think about that? All Rebecca wanted to, it was some reassurance that the boys were going to be okay, and God gives this national pronouncement. And he adds the point that the elder shall serve the younger. Now that is biblical language. We haven't got time to chase this through this evening, but that language, the elder shall serve the younger, is in fact the language of preeminence through both the birthright and the blessing. There's two facets to this. There is the birthright and there's the blessing. The birthright in Israel was in fact a position of spiritual responsibility. The firstborn was given the privilege, the double portion, which allowed him to receive the recompense, if you like, of spiritual ministration. in the absence of the Father, or permission of the Father, he would conduct the worship rituals, I use that expression, the worshipping standards, if you like, of the community. He was the channel by which men came to God. An exceedingly important responsibility, a spiritual responsibility. And the blessing, which is different to the birthright, the blessing is the pronouncement of the Abrahamic promises. They're both two distinct things. And they incorporate in this expression, the elder shall serve the younger. Now let's come across to Romans 9, because Paul now expounds the purpose of this declaration. Romans chapter 9. He's talking about a purpose of God. And we know the argument, don't we, that he's tracing through the fact that really the whole of Israel will never be saved, just a remnant. And that was demonstrated through the way in which God chose the seeds. Now, in verse 10, we read that not only this, but when Rebekah also had conceived by one, even by our father Isaac, for the children being not yet born, neither having done any good or evil, that the purpose of God according to the election might stand, not of works, but of him that calleth, it was said to her, the elder shall serve the younger. As it's written, Jacob have I loved, but Esau have I hated. What shall we say then? Is there unrighteousness with God? God forbid, by no means. Now Paul is making the point that before those children were even born, the purpose of God was fixed. How God knew that Jacob would be the appropriate boy and Esau would be the inappropriate son is beyond our comprehension and knowledge. But God understood that the makeup of those two boys, through election, through the calling of God, having nothing to do with works at all, works of law, but the purpose of God would stand in his righteousness. He made the right decision. Now of course, the Jew comes back and says, well, why does God find fault with people? I mean, if he made this selection that Esau and Jacob would be two entirely different people, how can he find fault with Esau? And Paul makes the point that even though he's made that sovereign decision, knowing that he's absolutely right in making that decision, he shows extensive mercy to the other individual who was not called and selected. And the example he gives is Pharaoh. God had raised up Pharaoh for a specific purpose, and extend to him unlimited mercy. Time and time and time again, he was given the opportunity to change and repent. And that's the way God's sovereign will works. Can't question that, says Paul. And even before those two children were born, the pronouncement was made of God's purpose, his promise, his election, his calling, was all on the basis of his will, his sovereign will. Always right, but there's an immense opportunity for the other individual to change when mercy is extended to him. Now, can you imagine the impact of this declaration? Come back to Genesis. Can you imagine the impact of this on the family? God was going to deliberately upset the harmony and unity and peace of this encampment by introducing division and strife. Now, is that the way of God? The blessings of the patriarch would now be under threat from the challenges of this boy Esau coming into their camp. Why would God do that? Why would he permit that? Why not just have one child who would become a great nation? And I think the reason is, brothers and sisters, is that faithful obedience can only really be manifested when there is tension and enmity that they have to confront. It is the enmity, it is the trial that tests and proves the faithfulness of the righteous. And you can imagine the upset that was now part of Rebekah's experience. But God does that. He introduces tension into our lives at times because he's there to test the faithfulness of the godly. Why do we have an irksome boss? Why do we have an environment that presses upon us? Why do we have conflicts in our family? Well, there are many reasons, but sometimes the providence of God is there to test us, to test our obedience, our faithfulness, and it was exactly that reason. So coming back to Genesis 25, we read there that verse 24, when her days to be delivered were fulfilled, behold, there were twins in her womb. And the first came out red all over, like a hairy garment, and they called his name Esau. Now, fathers, you've probably been present at the birth of your children. I think the last thing you'd expect would be a hairy carpet coming out all red. It would have been astounding, absolutely astounding. Red. I mean, this is a Middle East country where hair is black. And it's all over. A hairy garment. Keep your hand in Genesis. Come across to Zechariah 13. This is the only occurrence of that expression, hairy garment. And look at the context in which it appears. Zechariah chapter 13. Verse 4. It shall come to pass in that day that the prophet shall be ashamed, every one of his vision, when he hath prophesied. Neither shall they wear a rough garment to deceive. See the margin? A garment of hair to deceive. And that's, of course, a reference to the clerical monks of the apostasy. They wear deliberate garments. They're there to deceive people. So coming back to Genesis 25, this hairy garment, this child who had this blanket of hair, is going to be a child of deception. Not what he appears to be. And he was red all over. I mean, red is a symbol, isn't it, of sin? Isaiah chapter 1, verse 18. Red is a symbol of sin. And he's wearing a garment, as it were. He's like a fully grown child. He is a manifestation of the flesh in every way. And therefore they call his name Esau, which means rough or hairy. Now, I've been told that in the birth of twins, that generally there's about an hour or so between the birth of the first and the second child. But not in this case. As the first child is being born, there is no time gap between the second child because his hand of the second child is gripping the heel of the first child. And the record says in verse 26, his hand took hold on Esau's heel. And that word, take hold, means to seize. It wasn't just a gentle tap. He was hanging on and seizing that heel. Now, that is most unusual. So you imagine, at the birth, this is providential. A child like they've never, ever seen before, hairy and red all over. And there's no time difference between the second birth. In fact, the child is grabbing hold of the first child, trying to pull him back into the womb. This is unusual. This is providential. This is alarming. Hosea 12 verse 3 says that he took his brother by the heel in the womb. So even before the child was born, he was grasping the heel, seizing it, wrestling. Why the heel? Well, I'm sure we remember Genesis 3 verse 15, don't we? Thou shalt bruise his heel, says Genesis 3 verse 15. So grasping the heel is Jacob's problem. It's going to be Jacob's problem. He's going to be a heel catcher. The heel is the part of the body which is used by the serpent to crush and to overcome. And Jacob is identifying himself with that. And that's going to be Jacob's problem. Jacob's going to need to release that. Two manner of people, seed of the woman, seed of the serpent. And Jacob's problem is that even though he was born in the line of the seed of the woman, he's going to have the tendencies at times of the seed of the serpent. And God, through his providence, is going to change that individual to remove that influence from his life. Remarkable story. We are not immune, are we? Even though we are the seed of promise through baptism, we are not immune from the struggle of the serpent within. We never will be until the change of immortality occurs. No different to Jacob. God needs to eliminate that kind of thinking. And so this boy was called Heel Catcher. He was one who wanted to wrestle, therefore he was a heel catcher. And that's his problem from his very birth. That's the Syrian in him. To take advantage of others, to bypass the purpose of God, to seize the initiative in an ungodly way, that's the Syrian. Now passed through into Jacob. Well, in verse 27, the record says, the boys grew. How much is hidden in that phrase? What influences shaped their development? Because attitudes in children, habits in children are developed early, aren't they? And we know from the different outcomes what shaped their interest in this household. They were twins who looked nothing alike. They were polar opposite in interests and outcomes. Remarkable family. So we're told about Esau. Esau was a cunning hunter. The word means skillful. Acquainted with hunting. The last hunter was Ishmael, and the hunter before him was Nimrod. So you see, his pedigree is really not particularly spiritual, is it? A hunter. This is a lad who stalks the prey, enjoys the thrill of the chase, he revels in the killing. God never had in mind the killing of animals just for the sake of hunting. The absolute opposite of a man tending the encampment with all its responsibilities. He was free, carefree, chasing the hunt. That was his life. And the fact that he was skillful means that he spent a great deal of time in the field. The record says he's a man of the field. Of the field. Now, where have you heard that expression before? That's the place where Cain slew Abel. Two brothers, and one was a man of the field and slew his brother. And here's Esau in that same mold. Isaac was in the field meditating, but that's not his son Esau. Esau had no interest at all. He was free, carefree, no responsibilities. He was a lad who just enjoyed the outdoors, and the truth was a distant last in his life. And Jacob, says the record, as we saw last night, was a plain man. As I mentioned last night, it means upright. He was a godly young man, a God-fearing man. He was hardworking, he was vigilant, he was reliable. But he had this tremendous character flaw from Syria. We all have that character flaw. Sometimes it emerges at times where we don't want it to emerge, but it comes. It does come. And the record says that this man was dwelling in tents. So you have a man in the field and a man dwelling in tents. And it's not just the contrast of environments. There's a principle here. Keep your hand here. Come to Hebrews 11. That there was a deliberate choice by the patriarchs to live in tents. A deliberate choice. And Paul makes this point in Hebrews chapter 11. Let's come to that. So in Hebrews 11 verse 9, talking about Abraham, it says that by faith Abraham sojourned in a land of promise as in a strange country, dwelling in tents, tabernacles, with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise. Why did they deliberately do that? They left Ur of the Chaldees with its sophisticated society, with its three-story, four-story, five-story apartments that they discovered there in Ur. Lavish, wealthy city, they made a deliberate choice to leave all that behind and deliberately live in tents. Why? Verse 10, for he looked for a city which hath foundations, whose builder and maker is God. They were living impermanently because they wanted a more permanent structure in the future. I wonder whether we could have done that. I see some nice RVs here over the weekend. We're talking tents. 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, for a principle that they have nothing to do from the lifestyle that they've left in Ur of the Chaldees. Strangers and pilgrims looking for a better place. It's really a challenge, isn't it, when you think about that? A deliberate choice. Dwelling in tents was a symbol of adopting a life of sojourning by faith. And Jacob would have been involved in all the responsibilities of that encampment. And it was a massive encampment. Huge encampment. The inhabitants of the land said to Abraham, "Thou art a prince amongst us." He had hundreds of trained servants. He had alliances with Gentiles who accepted the covenant, which he also shared with them. It was a massive, like almost a little metropolis within the land. And to administer that and to care for that and to have the responsibility of that, that was Jacob. Esau didn't care a fig. He was out there hunting. No responsibilities. A dramatic change and difference between these two boys. Well, time moves on. And we have a division in the family, a parental division. And it's over the children. In verse 28, Isaac loved Esau because he did eat of his venison. Young's literal has, "for the hunting in his mouth." So the love that Isaac had for Esau was a love based upon his senses, his taste. Vicariously, he lived through his boy's hunting experiences. Isaac dwelt in tents, and he loved to hear the stories of his son, the way he chased roebucks over the hills and trapped this prey here and trapped that prey there. And Isaac reveled in all of that. Despite the fact that providentially this boy, this older boy, would not receive the dominion, even though he was in fact so totally devoid of spiritual interest, nevertheless, Isaac loved the boy. And it's based on senses. And Rebekah loved Jacob. There's no reason given. But the contrast is clear. This boy, Jacob, was a godly young boy. And Rebekah loved him for his character. Now that, parents, when one child is favored at the expense of another, is going to cause conflict with the parents. And it comes out in the record. We can't afford to have favorites, even though we do. Because that creates division between parents who are always defending the child that they love. And the children take advantage of that and play parent off parent. And this lovely family is now facing friction. And they're allowing the boys to divide them. Now, in verse 29, we come across this famous incident about the selling of the birthright. And I want to suggest that there is something in this record that doesn't actually add up, unless you delve a little bit deeply. I've always assumed, and I guess you learn it from Sunday school, that Esau's on a hunting trip and he came back, he hadn't found anything, and Jacob took advantage of that. Well, that's only partially true. What doesn't add up is this. He was a skillful hunter. The record makes that deliberately so. In other words, it would have been virtually impossible for Esau to come back without food. And also, Jacob, in preparing a meal, would have prepared this meal way, way out of the camp. If the meal was being prepared in the camp, Esau would have just come into the camp and picked up his food and gone. But quite clearly, Jacob is preparing this meal miles away from the camp. And he knows that Esau is coming in this direction. So I'm going to suggest to you that actually it wasn't a hunting trip he was coming back from. Jacob knew this path which Esau came, because he ambushed him, if you like. Now, keep your hand in Genesis, come across to Hebrews 11. Paul makes a point about Esau which is rather puzzling at first. But I think it gives us a clue as to the incident that's occurring in this record. Now, Hebrews 11. And we read a little incident about Hebrews 12, the characteristic of Esau. Hebrews 12. Verse 14, follow peace with all men and holiness, without which no man shall see the Lord. Hebrews 12, verse 14. Looking diligently, lest any man fail of the grace of God, lest any root of bitterness springing up trouble you, and thereby many be defiled. Lest, verse 16, there be any fornicator or profane person as Esau, who for one morsel of meat sold his birthright. Now we're told there that not only was Esau profane, he was a fornicator. Now we know from the record that he married two Hittite women, and the Hittite women lived in the vicinity of Hebron, and from Beersheba to Hebron is a significant journey, particularly in the heat of the day. I believe the record is saying that Esau was coming back from one of his trysts, and Jacob knew precisely the route he took. He knew precisely where Esau was going and knew precisely where he was coming back. And that's why he came faint without food, because he wasn't hunting. He was committing fornication. Now, back in Genesis 25, we're going to see another little clue about what's happening in this incident. Now, in Genesis chapter 27, we read a very interesting little point. Esau is a grown man. And yet in verse 15, Rebekah took goodly raiment of her eldest son Esau, which were with her in the house. Now Esau's a grown man. He goes out hunting, goes out fornicating. And yet Rebekah has the goodly garment, which belonged to Esau. Now what's that about? What is that goodly garment, and why has she got it in her house? He's a grown man. He can look after his own clothing. We know from Genesis 27 that when Jacob wore that garment, it had the smell of the field. Chapter 27, verse 27. The smell is the smell of the field. That goodly garment, brothers and sisters, is the garment that belonged to the firstborn. In fact, in the Septuagint translation, it's used as the high priest's garment. It's a special garment. So Esau is wearing the firstborn garment to go hunting, the smell of the field. And you could imagine Rebekah and Jacob seeing this desecration, this garment that was supposed to be holy, that was supposed to be used in the rite of the firstborn, that was used to officiate spiritual things taken by Esau and used for hunting. And I think that's what precipitated the action of Jacob and Rebekah. How did Rebekah get that garment? Well, most likely it came as a result of the transaction that Jacob had with Esau. Esau was coming back, smelling of the field. That garment, which had been desecrated by his activities, was just too much to take. So come back to Genesis 25. Verse 29. The record says, Jacob sod pottage. The word means to boil or to seethe. Just keep your hand here. Come across to Deuteronomy chapter 17. Now, frequently in the Hebrew language, you have words with a double meaning. And sometimes that double meaning actually gives us a little bit of a hint as to the significance of the word itself. So here it is in Deuteronomy 17. We read in verse 13 this. And all the people shall hear and fear and do no more presumptuously. And would you believe it or not, that word presumptuously is the same word sod in Genesis 25 and verse 29. It means to boil or to seethe, figuratively to be presumptuous. And that's Jacob's problem. He is impatient. He thinks that God is being slow giving him what he has promised. And seeing this garment defiled and desecrated by Esau's behavior was just too much. So he took things into his own hand without waiting for God. And as he's boiling and seething that pottage, it became a symbol of his own presumption to move without God, to take the matter into his own hands, to grasp something which really God needed to give him as opposed to him taking it. So Esau comes from the field, says Genesis 25 and verse 29. And, as I mentioned before, Jacob's there with this meal. He knows exactly where Esau is coming and going. He's observed that. He's ambushed him, if you like. They're miles away from anywhere, and there's this lovely meal. If you think lentils is lovely. But it's food. And here, the real Esau comes out. In verse 30, Esau said to Jacob, in very telling language, "Feed me, I pray thee, with this same red pottage." Now, I want you to notice that Jacob did not offer Esau the food. Now, this is a bit callous, isn't it, really, when you think about it? You know, the Proverbs tell us that we should feed our enemies. There was no such thought at all in Jacob's mind. He's just sitting there, and he knows the smell of this lentils is affecting Esau, and Esau acts first. Jacob doesn't offer. Esau makes the request. "Feed me." And the Hebrew word means to swallow greedily. Rotham translates that. "Do let me devour. I'm ravenous, I'm starving, let me devour now this red, red." He tells us a bit about Jacob's cooking. He couldn't identify what the red was. It was just red, but it smelt good. It was red, red. "For I am faint." Now here's an individual who is acting on his sense of hunger. This is how Esau actually reacts. It's based upon his senses. There is no sense of anything spiritual this day. And therefore he's called Edom. In fact, he wasn't called Edom until right at the end of his life when the sons of Edom were in fact born. But it became the development of this redness, this antagonism that was now about to develop between these two people. As I said before, Jacob had any spiritual thought, he would have offered Esau the food without any preconditions. "If thine enemy be hungry, give him bread to eat." Proverbs 25, verse 21. But that was not in his thought, never entertained. This was an ambush. "Sell me this day, now, immediately." So this is blackmail. You know, you're hungry, you're dying. "Sell me this day thy birthright." Esau now had a choice to make. Food, birthright. Promises to Abraham, everlasting life, or a pottage of vegetables. That was the choice. And Esau could have turned around and said, "No, the birthright's important to me. I won't sell it, but please, out of desperation, can I have some food?" He could have easily rejected the offer, but he didn't. In fact, he said in verse 32, "Behold, I am at the point to die. What profit shall this birthright do to me?" And there's his problem. He is a man of the here and the now. The future, the promise of everlasting life, the promise of inheritance, the promise of spiritually being a leader of the house, zero interest. They had responsibilities which he placed no value on at all. Nothing whatsoever entered his mind spiritually. Everlasting life or a bowl of vegetables? And sometimes in life, brothers and sisters, we make the wrong choice. We value the things that we can see and feel and touch more important than the promises that God has made to us. Peter calls them exceedingly great promises. We should never devalue the power of the promises that God has made with us. And Jacob didn't let it lie there. Swear to me, he said. Swear to me. Now, I believe that part of that transaction involved those garments. That's how Rebekah got the garment. That was the trade. Now, all of this incident, brothers and sisters, has some powerful lessons for us. Very powerful. The first is this. Be careful, parents, what you encourage your children in. Esau was born into a godly home. The promises of God were known. The laws of God were known. In fact, it was an encampment that had communication with Almighty God through prayer. But the one parent encouraged this child to be out there in the sports field, in the hunting field, outside the camp, carefree, no responsibilities, encouraged by one of the parents. We need to be very careful, parents, what we encourage in our children. They may be good at some sort of physical thing, which we as parents delight in, but you let that travel to its natural conclusion. Professional sport, professional this, professional that, and you're asking for trouble. Be careful what you encourage your children in. The second lesson is this, is that sometimes small choices have dramatic consequences. You see, sometimes we are faced with making a snap decision. Here's Esau, on the point of death, exhausted, physically exhausted, and he's presented with a choice, the truth and everlasting life, or the things of this world now. A snap decision needs to be made. And sometimes it's those trivial incidents that trigger important decisions in our life. Maybe it's an offer by a friend to do something immoral. Perhaps an opportunity arises to cheat on your partner. Perhaps you're going to make a lot of money in a wrong way. All sorts of decisions, snap decisions, are sometimes offered to us. And they're like chalk and cheese. They're like everlasting life or the things of this world. And you need to make a quick decision. Sometimes we don't make the right decision. In the end, that boy lost the inheritance of everlasting life because of that. And sometimes those small choices have dramatic consequences. And they come unexpectedly when you least expect them. And thirdly, don't be confused about what's important, what's essential, and what's not. What's the point of gaining the whole world and losing your inheritance? Sometimes we spend hours wasted on inane things. And we neglect the things of everlasting life. Where is the priority? And this boy Esau's life, he was at the meetings, in the encampment, in a godly environment, but the truth had made zero impact. We're going to make sure, brothers and sisters, that our children are affected by the things of the truth. Not just the stories, they're important. The moral principles with those stories to make an impact on our children. We don't want to end up with children like Esau. Well, the trade was made in verse 34. Jacob gave Esau bread and porridge of lentils. He did eat and drink and rose up and went his way. Thus Esau despised his birthright. He did eat and drink and rose up. You know where that language occurs again? That language occurs again in Exodus chapter 32, verse 6, where the children of Israel did eat and drink and rose up to play. They were fixated with idolatry, and that was Esau's problem. He was fixated with the here and the now. Give me now this pottage. Give it to me now. I need my satisfaction now. That's the world we live in. Give it to me now. I can't wait. Deferred enjoyment, forget it. I want it now. That's Esau, that's our world. And he went his way, not God's way, he went his way. He held the truth in contempt. There's not a spiritual bone in his life, and thus he despised the birthright. We cannot afford to do the same. The exceedingly precious promises that have been given to us offer us everlasting life. We cannot devalue those. Well, when we come to Genesis chapter 27, we come across an incident in which the family now is divided more than ever. Esau marries, and that introduces another problem into the camp. If he brought his wives into the camp, which has most likely occurred, he's brought two Hittite women into a Hebrew camp. You imagine the tension that creates. Bad enough for Esau to be there, but bringing these two wives in who were idolaters would have been, and the record says, a source of grief to both Isaac and Rebekah. And you can imagine the disappointment of the parents in this particular marriage. Now, in chapter 27, verse 1, we now come across another incident that consolidates the deceit of Jacob. Isaac is blind. He's blind to the promises that God gave through Rebekah. Tragically, he's blinded by his emotions. He is in every sense blind. And the record says in 27 verse 1 that he called Esau his eldest son. In the Hebrew, it's Esau, his son, the great. This boy has been elevated despite the fact that he is unspiritual, despite the fact that he has given away and despised his birthright. He is, in Isaac's mind, the great. And it's now time to pass the blessing on. Now, we've spoken about the tension in the family. The division between Isaac and Rebekah now intensifies, you see, because Isaac is going to surreptitiously bless his son Esau without the knowledge of his wife, without the knowledge of Jacob. Now you think, brethren, of the implications of that. You're going to do something behind your wife's back of profound significance. Now, normally, when the blessing is given, it's done in a wonderful sense of spiritual thanksgiving and wonder. But this is now being done behind Rebekah's back. But the problem is in verse 5 is that Rebekah is listening to all of this. So she doesn't trust Isaac. This is a loving couple that love each other greatly, but now this communication is breaking down to suspicion. So that Rebekah doesn't trust Isaac, and she's listening. In fact, the Hebrew scholars tell us that expression "heard" is a continuous thing. She was listening continually. It was her habit to check on her husband. She didn't trust him. Now, this is an awful situation in a godly family. Awful situation. Isaac felt he was going to die. In fact, he lived another 63 years, so he's a little bit premature. But he panicked. And what was pressing in his uppermost mind, this sense of urgency, that I've got to do something to promote Esau in the home, contrary to the purpose and will of God. He wanted in verse 4 to bless Esau before he died. Division in a godly home is awful to behold. Two godly parents divided by their children is going to cause absolute chaos and suspicion, and it did. She was listening. Verse 5, she was listening when Isaac spake to Esau his son, and Esau went to the field to hunt for venison and to bring it. Now, what would you do if you were Rebekah? You have a source of information. Your husband is now going to precipitate this crisis. He's going to do it behind your back. What would you do, sisters, if that happened in your home? Good question, isn't it? What would you do? Well, I think the godly approach would be to take it to God in prayer, to seek his providential interference, I can use that word, in this arrangement, to seek help from God. But she doesn't. The Syrian is going to actually prevail. And as she's looking at this, God is far distant from her thoughts. She has to solve this problem practically. This is the Syrian. And she's torn, isn't she? She's torn between supporting her husband and supporting the purpose of God. But we can never limit God's actions. God would have had a contingency plan in place to make sure this didn't happen. But Rebecca didn't believe that. Sometimes we're like that. Sometimes we want to nefariously promote something in the truth that we think the means justifies the end. But it doesn't at all. She should have gone to her husband perhaps and appealed to him and then taken the matter to God in prayer, but she didn't. And verse 8 says, she said to Jacob, "Therefore, my son, obey my voice." Where have you heard that language before? Obey my voice. That was Adam's problem in the garden, because you have obeyed the voice of your wife. It's used of Sarah. Abraham obeyed the voice of Sarah. And in each of those situations, it was disastrous. And so it is here. My son, obey my voice. And the problem with Rebecca and Jacob is, I will do, I will make, I will achieve, I will solve. That's her problem. Now, you're Jacob. How are you going to respond to that? The mother whom you love is going to suggest to you a way around this particular problem. Now, you could reject that and say, look, Mum, I know you have the best intentions, but that's not the right thing to do. But no. Verse 11, Jacob says, I've got a problem with that, but it's a practical problem. My brother is hairy and I am smooth. My father peradventure will feel me, and I shall seem to be him as a deceiver. And I shall bring a curse upon me and not a blessing. So his response is, well, how can we get round the problem? Not that it's wrong, not that we should be doing that. How can I best get round this problem? That's Syrian thinking. There is no trust at all before God. I shall seem in his eyes to be a deceiver. But what about God's eyes? God didn't appear in this particular equation. And in the end, he did appear as a deceiver. Now, Rebecca, she says to her boy, Jacob, upon me be thy curse. She was so determined, I will take all responsibility. And you know, she did. After this incident, when Jacob was sent away to Syria, she never saw her beloved son ever again. Ever again. And by saying, I will accept the curse, was a tragic, tragic thing. And Jacob, having accepted the fact that his mum's going to take all the responsibility, now works with her to deceive the father. The record says that Isaac was deceived by coats of skin. Now, isn't that interesting? Verse 16. Coats of skin. Coats of skin were used by the Elohim in Genesis chapter 3 to cover the iniquity of Adam and Eve. And here, coats of skin are going to be used to deceive Isaac. And later on, Jacob is going to be deceived by a garment. So, the wheel of irony, divine irony, will turn once more upon them. Now, this incident is very dramatic, isn't it? So here comes Jacob. He's clothed with this goat skin, which is very soft to the touch, feels like a hairy garment. And in verse 22, he comes near, and by putting on a hairy garment, he becomes Esau. He has spiritually descended from Jacob to Esau. He is Esau. His father feels him and says, the voice is Jacob's, verse 22, but the hands are the hands of Esau. He says one thing, but something else betrays him. This is the duplicity here. Are you my very son Esau? And we find that Jacob's answers get shorter and shorter and shorter because, you see, the conscience being pricked. Are you really my son Esau? Yes, I am. Really, truly? Yes. And every time those questions are asked, the deception digs deeper and deeper and the lies multiplies. What if Esau had arrived 5 minutes earlier? The whole game of deception would have been up. But Isaac's suspicious, you see, because the language that Jacob is using is introducing the Yahweh name. Now, Esau would never, never use the Yahweh name. And that makes Isaac suspicious, and he asks more probing questions. But in the end, he blesses this boy, and immediately Esau arrives, and Isaac trembles before Almighty God. Now, I think, brothers and sisters, what happened is that as Isaac suddenly realizes that Jacob has deceived him and that Esau now is the child in front of him, the second child, that he realized that God had caught him out. And there was a great shaking and trembling in his life. As all of a sudden he realized that God had intervened, and he is trembling and shaking. The Hebrew is very expressive in that. You ever been in that situation, brothers and sisters? Where you might be doing something wrong, and all of a sudden a brother and sister appears in front of you, and you have such a guilty conscience, you have such a striking of the conscience that it actually makes you physically tremble, because you know you've been caught out. And I think, brothers and sisters, that's exactly how Isaac felt. And despite Esau's tears, despite the fact that he pleaded with his father, Isaac suddenly realized that in the end, the promises of God were absolutely right, and the elder shall serve the younger. And the blessing that he gave Esau was an entirely different blessing than he gave Jacob. Brothers and sisters, the lessons of Esau and Jacob are very, very apparent today. Spirituality is developed by the heart and the conscience being affected by the Word of God. We can be in the meeting, we can attend the meetings, and the meetings have little impact upon us. We have to individually, spiritually, connect with Almighty God through His Son, Jesus Christ. Unless the heart is transformed, the conscience is transformed, we will end up just being an Esau. We're in a godly camp. But has the truth really affected us? And if it has affected us, how do we react to that? Are we a little bit deceptive about our lives? Are we a little bit Syrian in the way we approach our brothers and sisters? Are we like Jacob, who looks about the consequences, not really the morality of what he's doing? They're very significant lessons for us to understand. Two different people, two different nations, two entirely different people, but they were in the same camp. Brothers and sisters, we have to appreciate the truth has to affect us individually. We have to be changed. The law of God must be part of us, meditating therein day and night. And if we can do that, we will inherit the glorious blessing of the future age.